Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. Earlier this week, President Obama signed a national service bill to get Americans to do more volunteer work. Well, he's talking Bob Graham's language. The former senator and governor of Florida says you can't have good government in your town or in Washington if Americans themselves aren't taking part in government. And he's on a crusade to teach young Americans how to play the democracy game. This hour on Point, Bob Graham's call to service and civics. You can join the conversation. Are you involved in your town hall meetings? Or did you throw your hands up long ago? Admit it, do you know a lot less about how your local, state, and federal government works than you really should? Joining me now from Miami is former Senator and Governor Bob Graham. He is, among other things, chairman of the Graham Center for Public Service at Miami University, and he's out with a new book called America, the Owner's Manual, Making Government Work for You. Senator Graham, welcome to On Point. Nice to have you.
Thank you very much, Jane. As you said, I'm passionate about this subject, and I appreciate the chance to discuss it with you and your audience.
Well, thank you. Tell us right out of the gate, how would you describe the state of citizenry in America today?
Declining. Over the last 40 years, there's been a sharp decline in almost every indicator of civic participation. As an example, we reached a high point of youth voting the first time all Americans over the age of 18 were constitutionally entitled to vote, which was in 1972. Every election since that time until 2004 saw a decline in youth vote. There was a slight uptick in 04. There was a somewhat larger uptick in 08. That gives hope and promise that maybe we're now in a period where this long siege of lethargy and indifference is about to be replaced with a more active, involved citizenry, particularly among young people.
Despite the uptick, I was curious and interested in the story you wrote in the St. Petersburg Times, where you talked about civics that are taught in school these days. And you cite some interesting statistics that say 81% of 8th graders and 12th grade students reported learning most about what they know about civics from watching television or in a class video. And there was an interesting racial component to that report as well, that African-American and Hispanic low-income students were twice as likely as their white counterparts to score below proficient in civics lessons. So tell us why understanding of civics and involvement in these matters is healthy and essential for an American democracy.
Well, our democracy was never intended to be a spectator sport. It always was predicated on citizens taking an active role in their government. You go back to the earliest days of public education when Thomas Jefferson said that a primary purpose of public education was to inform citizens of their rights and responsibilities and provide them with the competencies to discharge those rights and responsibilities to their neighbors and their nation. We've lost touch of that concept of the importance of citizenship as part of our education system, and to the degree that citizenship is being taught, it's being taught, in my judgment, similar to music appreciation. Students are learning to sit in the audience and listen to the orchestra or watch their democracy with greater understanding, but they're not being taught to play the violin or to play the critical roles that citizens have available to them in our democracy to make government work as they wish it would.
So take us back to a time, Senator Graham, when Americans did come together in trade unions or public forums, when citizens from all walks of life shaped their community life, especially at the local level. How has civic involvement and civic life changed fundamentally in recent decades?
If you read the works of de Tocqueville, the Frenchman who traveled over the United States in the 1830s and wrote about what he saw in this new democracy, one of the things that most impressed him was the fact that everyone was involved on the town square. People from all backgrounds, all levels of education came together and actively discussed the issues that would affect that community or their nation. People had a pattern of participating and helping their fellow citizens. The raising the barn over the weekend for the new neighbor who has come into the community, it would be exemplary of that. We've lost much of that spirit of community participation. There's a book by a Harvard professor, Bob Putnam, called Bowling Alone, which draws its title from the fact that Americans have stopped joining in the numbers that they have traditionally in everything from civic organizations to bowling leagues.
So do ordinary citizens have fewer opportunities for active participation civically than they used to, or what's at the heart of this?
No, I think they have the same level of opportunities. It's that they're not taking advantage of them. And I think at the heart of it is that some of our fundamental institutions are not serving as well. One is the political parties. They used to have as their objective getting people to become citizens and become actively involved. Today, many political parties have the theory that the only thing that counts is their base vote, their true believers, and they're almost positively discouraging other people from participating. The media, most people become active in civic and public life at the local level. In order to do so, you have to know what's going on at the local level, particularly in television, but increasingly in radio and newspapers as well. There's less and less coverage of what's happening in the immediate community, therefore less opportunity for citizens to get involved. And then finally is education. I was in high school in the 1950s. I took 3 one-year courses in civics from the 7th grade to the 12th grade. Today, a student is lucky to get one, and that will typically be a semester, and frequently it'll be a mixture of civics, geography, and history.
Right.
So our students are significantly less educated as to their rights, responsibilities, and have the ability to gain the competencies to discharge.
And there was a specific point in the book where you talk about how that education has changed and how that civics education, as you mentioned, was an important and significant part of this curriculum in public schools until, you say in the book, in the 1970s. What happened?
Well, you ask the question about what's a good example of people coming together constructively assisting citizenship. It happened, and it happened about 135 or 40 years ago in America when the first big waves of non-English immigrants began to come to the United States from the Mediterranean and Central Europe. There was a recognition that the children of those new immigrants had not had the exposure to democracy that children growing up in the U.S. had, and therefore the level of civics in our public schools for a period of two generations was elevated specifically to assist the new arrivals in understanding what it meant to live in a democracy. Ironically, today, when we have not as great but a similar wave of new arrivals in the United States, this time primarily from Latin America and Asia, instead of recognizing the need to increase civics in our schools, it's been declining.
There was an op-ed piece in the New York Times recently talking about civic involvement, and it suggested that in America today, widespread anger and passivity exist side by side, and that American anger is corralled not on the streets, as it used to be so much, but on the internet. And so I'm curious, Senator Graham, do you think we've made a turn culturally because of our technology? Are we all home blogging and expressing our rage on the internet rather than doing really something about it?
America has had a number of themes, and one of those has been the conflict between individuality and community. We tend to be a very individual society when times are good and people are looking for ways in which they can further improve their economic well-being. And we've been through such a period for much of the last couple of decades. In periods of stress, whether it's war or economic stress, people tend to come together and form communities. We're now in that period, and I think if your listeners may be seeing that there are increasing examples of people coming together to deal with the common economic distress that our nation is facing. So I don't think we've lost the spirit of community. It's been tamped down by ignorance, lack of involvement by important institutions, and the generally good times that have encouraged more focus on me rather than us. I'm hopeful that 2008 may represent a turning point in all of that.
So you wrote this book for what purpose? You say it's not a how-to book, but you want to engage people in the citizenry, especially young people, in a way that they haven't been before.
The first thing we wanted to do with the book was to overcome the sense that you can't fight City Hall. And I will say, from talking to many college audiences, that seems to be a very prevalent attitude. When you point out here is a problem, including a problem that directly affects you as a college student, the reaction is, well, there's nothing I can do about that. I just have to accept it.
Mm-hmm.
In order to indicate that that's not the case, we start each chapter with a rather detailed case study of how a citizen or a group of citizens saw a problem, generally at the community level. They use the skills of effective participatory citizenship, and they solve the problem. And their community was a better place because of their efforts. Each of the chapters of the book, 10, are devoted to one of the essential skill sets for effective citizenship.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour about how to get a new generation of young Americans interested in taking part in the running of their towns and, in fact, the whole country. My guest is former senator, governor, and former chairman of the Senate Select Committee, a man who has himself devoted long years to local and national government, Bob Graham. He's out with a new book called America, the Owner's Manual, Making Government Work for You. Senator Graham, we talked before the break about some of the problems associated with civic participation. You talk in the book about the decline that has been accelerated in the last few years by tests and testing like those mandated by No Child Left Behind, where civics isn't really tested, so teachers are dropping it or ignoring it to focus on other things like reading and arithmetic. Is that not true?
That has been one of the contributing factors to this decline. In the last 10 or 15 years, most states have adopted some high-stakes testing, and those items that are tested tend to be taught and generally taught well because the school understands that it's going to be evaluated by the outcome. On the reverse, if you're not going to be tested, then you wither on the curriculum. And one of the major casualties of high-stake tests has been civics, as well as the other social studies. History, geography, economics are also less taught and probably less well taught today than they were 25 years ago. We're trying here in Florida to get civics and other social studies returned to testing so that there will be a measure of how well we're doing, and the people who are developing the curriculum at the school level will understand this is important to do and to do well. It's been surprising to me how frequently difficult it is to persuade people who are professional public servants, such as members of the legislature, that this is an important issue. Most professions, whether you're an architect or an accountant or a doctor, you have a sense of responsibility to assure that there is another generation of your profession coming through the educational process. Public officials don't seem to evince that same awareness as it relates to preparing the next generation of citizens to be engaged public citizens and frequently to be public officials.
Let me bring a caller into this conversation at this point. Ruth is on the line. She's in Boston. Welcome to On Point, Ruth.
Thanks. Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call. I have two comments. Well, first of all, this is just an absolutely fascinating topic. I think about it a lot. And I live in a small town outside of Boston, and I very much want to become involved in my government, but it's very hard because a lot of the meetings happen during the day. and I work full time. I'm trying to join the Disability Commission, and they meet at you know, like 1 o'clock every fourth Wednesday of the month.
Mm-hmm.
So I am trying to figure out a way to work at home that day, and I don't know whether or not it's something I should ask my employer about, you know, as far as why I want to work at home.
Yeah.
It's sort of complicated.
So the practicalities of this, yeah.
Yeah, it's not easy, you know. I mean, I work full-time. I have, you know, family responsibilities. My second comment is that I went to a very good high school in suburban Philadelphia and felt that I had a good education and went off to Oberlin College, where I wanted to be a government major, and I took a 100-level government class, and I was totally lost.
Mm.
I had no idea what the professor was talking about. And I don't know if that's a statement more on whether I wasn't educated properly in high school or if the college professor was making assumptions. But I realized I had no idea how the government worked, my role in it, and it took me years to figure it out. I had to figure
to
it
catch
out on
up.
My own.
Interesting. Ruth, thanks so much for the call. Senator Graham, a couple of good points there.
Yeah, I'd like to particularly comment about the first one, the fact that the lady wants to be involved but can't because the meetings are held during the day when she's at work. That is a political issue. Let me give an analogy. I spoke recently to a group of college students who had a class project in which each student had to write a letter to one of their local representatives, county commissioner, state legislature, with some issue that concerned them. About 25 students wrote these letters. After several weeks, less than five had even gotten a reply, and they were upset about that. And I said, you know, what you have just unearthed here is a political problem, non-responsive elected officials. And what are you going to do about it? Well, they scratched their heads, and what they decided to do was to have a press conference in which they would announce to the local media what was the non-responsiveness of elected officials. That was a creative idea, and I bet it got a higher level of response from that point forward. This lady has identified a problem, and that is that local government holds its meetings at a time when many citizens are unable to be engaged. I would go to the local town council or whatever it is in her community and ask that they hold their meetings at 7 o'clock at night or sometime that would be more accessible. That's a political issue, and the same skills that can be used in any other area could be used to get that city council to change its meeting time.
I'd like to bring another voice into the conversation now, Senator Graham. Joining us from Leesburg, Virginia, is Lori Waters. She's a member of the Board of Supervisors for Loudoun County, Virginia, representing the district of Broad Run. She's currently serving the second year of her second four-year term, and she's also a former executive director of the Eagle Forum, a conservative interest group. Welcome, Lori. Nice to have you.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
What are the trends that you're seeing, Lori, at the grassroots level in terms of civic participation where you are?
Well, being involved in Loudoun County, which has been one of the fastest-growing counties in the nation, shows that we have a lot of people who want to be here, but a lot of controversy because of the change. And so I see that people do get involved at the local level when something's happening next door or in their backyard or impacts their local schools. And when it comes home that there's going to be an impact on their family, that's when we really see that they turn out.
So there's more interest in national elections, per se, than local issues, unless it affects them personally.
Right. We see in our voting trends that there'll be very high turnout during the presidential years and upwards of 70, 80, 85%. But then when we have local elections, it drops down to about 30%. And it's only when people realize how many decisions are made at the local level that impact their daily lives, that's when they recognize I need to be more involved and more in tune with what's happening down at the local government center.
What about the demographics of this, Lori? Do you see young people involved at all? Do high school kids show up at your town meetings? Are you seeing involvement by them?
We do see more involvement by them. Loudoun County is a mix of suburban and rural. We're about 30 miles west of Washington, D.C., so when we see what happens in Congress every day, that's pretty much our local and regional news. So we're very much of a suburban community, very pro-family, and we have a lot of educated professionals here, and mm-hmm. they're raising their children to, you know what's going on and to become more involved. And so we have a advisory commission on youth with a youth council, and they've become very active volunteers in the community over the last 5 years.
How do you take advantage of technology, Lori, to broaden your audience at your meetings and in other ways?
We, within the last 5 years, I made a big push for us to start webcasting our meetings so that people would be able to know what's going on without having to sit through the long, you know, 6-8 hour sessions throughout the day. And so webcasting has really enabled them to follow what's going on. And we're also seeing just tremendous levels of email that come in with people expressing their opinions. We'll get, you know, hundreds and hundreds of emails for every one person that may show up to actually speak at the meeting because people are busy with their lives and with their kids. So it's hard for them to, you know, especially with the traffic also in Washington, D.C., it's tough to get, you know, down to the government center at 6:30 to speak even. So technology has really enabled people to get more involved.
Let's bring a caller into this conversation at this point. Jesse is on the line from Charlotte, North Carolina. Hi, Jesse. Welcome.
Hi, how are you doing?
Hi, go ahead.
To kind of, I guess, go against what your previous caller was saying there, I wanted to ask if you think that suburban living has possibly kind of done something to fracture the civic, you know, mentality of mm-hmm. communities, because mm-hmm. I was fortunate enough to grow up with both my parents being career military, and I've always had a sense of duty instilled in me and have tried to be actively participating in every community that I've lived in, but I keep finding it harder and harder, and it seems like different parts of the government are less friendly to outside voices or people trying to become involved even to a certain extent.
That's a good point, Jesse. Thank you. Senator Graham, has suburban living changed the way we think about civic participation in some way?
I think it has had the effect of making people less rooted. Americans today move 6 or 7 times during their lifetime. And therefore don't have the deep sense of connectedness that our parents or grandparents had. I see that as being a reality, and then you need to figure out how to deal with it, not just bemoan it.
President Obama's presidential campaign politicized and organized young people in a way that many campaigns haven't seen in recent memory. And on Tuesday, the president signed into law, the Edward M. Kennedy Serve America Act, named after the Massachusetts senator who was the main architect of the legislation. And that legislation will triple the size of the AmeriCorps program in less than a decade. In his concluding remarks before signing the bill, the president called on all Americans to serve.
We need your service. Right now, at this moment in history, I'm not going to tell you what your role should be. That's for you to discover. But I'm asking you to stand up and play your part. I'm asking you to help change history's course. Put your shoulder up against the wheel. And if you do, I promise you, your life will be richer, our country will be stronger, and someday, years from now, you may remember it as the moment when your own story and the American story converged, when they came together. And we met the challenges of our new century.
Senator Graham's service, involvement, what's the lesson from the Obama campaign about involving a younger generation of Americans in civic life?
I think the lesson is one of empowerment, that you have the ability to make a difference, that you don't have to just sit in the audience and listen, that you can shape what is going to happen on the stage. Those students who were pointing out the lack of responsiveness of their elected officials. They were serving America. They were serving democracy. There are many ways in which that service can be achieved. I believe that participation in your local communities, working to see that your schools are that the level of quality that your children expect, seeing that your local government is responsive to the range of needs for your community, those are all very important examples of service to neighbor, service to nation.
Lori Waters, what do you make of President Obama and young people sort of getting involved in community organizing, really for the first time, many of them?
Well, I think it's good to encourage it. I think one of the things that discourages people from getting involved, whether they're in their 20s or 30s or beyond, is that politics can be very nasty sometimes, and it's when they see the negative side of government, that turns a lot of people off. And so it takes a lot of effort for good people to put their neck out there and run for office and to be able to take the level of criticism, you know, some fair, some unfair. But I think it takes more of those good people getting involved to want to have the change and then just stay strong through it, because that's the only way we're going to have an impact.
To this point, here's a comment from Tim from our website. He says, an active electorate is key to democracy. However, when both political parties seem to be virtually identical, it makes voting seem pointless. I had hope in Obama, but his actions since taking office show that he is just as beholden to commercial interests as any previous politician. How can we keep our hopes up when they are dashed in each election cycle? Senator Graham, what do you make of that kind of a comment and that kind of a sentiment?
Yeah, well, first, I would disagree with the premise of that question. I think that there are few elections in my lifetime which have been as consequential as the presidential election of 2008. The American people had very distinctly different paths for the future in the candidates that were available to them. And the candidates did not shirk from pointing out those differences. And I believe in now the first 100 days of the Obama administration, you're seeing a very distinct difference. The controversy this week about the release of information about excessive interrogations, or call it torture, is illustrative of the difference that is resulting from the outcome of the 2008 election. But I think we have a tendency to overly emphasize the big national elections and the electoral process itself. What I think is at least equally important is what the citizens do as direct participants, not depending upon their elected officials, but what do they do as an individual in order to change the course of history for their community or their nation.
Lori Waters, quickly before our break, do you hear the apathy of the website comment, our listener Tim, where you are?
Sometimes, but I think that people can overcome that and just see that no politician is ever going to be perfect. And unless the individual stays engaged, holds the elected officials accountable, and even runs themselves, you can't just give up on the system.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about citizens and politics, about why you or your children should be out there fighting over traffic lights and zoning and budgets and school books to make your local communities a better place. My guest this hour, Bob Graham, former senator and governor of Florida. He's chairman of the Graham Center for Public Service at Miami University, and he's out with a new book called America, The Owner's Manual, Making Government Work for You. And Lori Waters, member of the Board of Supervisors for Loudoun County, Virginia, first elected in 2004. She's in the second year of her second four-year term, working on the ground at the grassroots. Let's go back to the phones in Barrington, Rhode Island. Christina is on the line. Christina, welcome.
Hi, thank you very much. Mm-hmm. I'm mainly calling, I absolutely support this effort, but I'm calling because I worry about some of the tone, most particularly because of Senator Graham's reference to the barn raising and everyone was involved and so on and so forth. And I know that you're talking about civics rather than history, but civics is going to be based on our concepts of our own history. And you asked about young people of color and why they seem to do less well. If I were a young person today, I would be watching some of the fabulous PBS shows like the Slavery and the Making of America series. I would be watching The We Shall Remain about Native Americans. I actually am watching those, and they're amazing. And they're pointing out that a lot of the way I was taught history, anyway, was very jingoistic and is not backed up by primary source materials at all. The country was not really based on the drive towards freedom, as we sometimes suggest that word should be interpreted. Specifically, maybe the Puritans had more a concept of religious freedom, but Virginia, where my African American and Native American relatives were from, it was really about land and very quickly about slavery and the freedom to own slaves. And I'm just afraid that if the examples that are used in the books are jingoistic, that kids who are engaged in finding out about their own family's history or about the history of the nation will be completely turned off.
Thank you, Christina. I appreciate your call. Senator Graham, would you respond?
I think that's a very good point. And I think throughout our history, we have not been a perfect society. We've had many faults. But I think one of the strengths is that we've had the willingness to recognize those faults, and we aspire to be better people. Examples of people working together are not exclusive to one historical strain of America. It permeates all of our people. The history of the black church and how people in very desperate circumstances found a place to come together, and eventually that black church became a key part of the political process that fundamentally changed America would be another example of in our history of people working together to achieve great things.
Here's Jesse. He's on the line from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Jesse, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for letting me on. I just wanted to share that I'm 28 years old, so mm-hmm. I'm in this generation of often uninvolved young people, mm-hmm. and I was raised in a family that was very political, and I went to precinct caucuses with my family. My father is actually a city councilor, or was a city councilor in Minnesota. Mm-hmm. I try to be very involved in my local community and try to encourage my friends and cohorts to be involved. We have city elections, municipal elections here every 2 years, and I try to send an email out to everyone I know, telling them about the major issues and who the candidates are, because I know that without sort of that prodding from me, they probably wouldn't vote, because I think that most people my age, you know, it's easy to get excited about whether it's abortion or gay rights, whatever side of the issue you're on, but when you're talking about zoning or street sweeping and things like that, and mm-hmm. it's harder to see how you're going to have any impact on that, or why it's even really important to do that. So,
Jesse, it's really good. Thank you very much, and keep going, doing what you're doing, Senator Graham. How do we clone Jesse? What are the solutions here? Give us some how-tos. Give us a 1-2. Some points that we can take home and actually utilize.
Well, I believe very strongly that community service is the front door to effective citizenship. For most people, it's the way in which they learn about their community. Young people have grown up in a home, in a neighborhood. They've been relatively protected from outside influences. When they then go down to the homeless shelter or to a Habitat for Humanity project, they will begin to see what some of the rest of their neighbors experience, how they experience life. That community service becomes the spark for civic activism. For other people, it may be a personal experience. One of our case studies involves the development of the Mothers Against Drunk Driving. It started with a lady, a housewife in Sacramento, California, Candy Leichner, whose teenage daughter was killed by a drunk driver. She grieved, but she also decided that she was going to do more than grieve, that she would do something about it. Her daughter was one of 27,000 people in that year in the late 1980s killed by a drunk driver. By her efforts and the efforts of those drawn to the cause of MAD, the age of drinking was increased from 18 to 21. The level of alcohol in your system that would make you subject to drunk driving was reduced by approximately 20%.
So find there the spark in your own life that brings you to some sort of civic activism, whatever it may be.
And there were 27,000 drunk driving deaths in the late 1980s. Last year, there were less than 15,000 drunk driving deaths in a much larger America. That's what one person who's committed to make a difference can accomplish.
Lori Waters, is the world of social media the key to energizing youth participation?
I think it is going to be a huge avenue in the coming elections. We've seen here in our county the impact that local blogs can have. While there's a lot of lurkers who read on it, there's just a few people posting, but I think that is going to change because we've seen that blogs have an impact. More people are organizing through Facebook. We've had some instances here recently regarding some school boundary changes, and the various sides have put together Facebook pages and websites and really used technology to help organize their efforts. And they're finding it does have an impact. We just have a very connected society, and particularly more so in our locality, and that's, I think that's going to be a huge wave that candidates and elected officials are going to have to really jump into and know how to use well and use it as a communication tool to really inspire people to get involved. And, you know, based on what your caller just said, you know, sometimes zoning can be very dry, but when you put it in the terms of, well, the locality could go a pro-growth or a slow-growth or a smart-growth perspective, and what does that mean of, okay, do you want mixed use, more residential, more commercial here, or do you want to continue the development pattern, or if you're talking about a specific, mm-hmm. you know, road that you need to have improved mm-hmm. and an interchange can make all that difference in someone's daily commute, it's really personalizing it to what has the greatest impact on their daily lives. And I'm finding here that it's not the national issues, the controversies like abortion or gay rights. They're not the things that are mobilizing people to come out and be involved. It's what is impacting them on a daily basis at the local level.
Here's another call. Casey is in East Dubuque, Illinois. Casey, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Jane, and I'd like to challenge your listeners to do what we're doing right here in Joe Davis County, Illinois. We have something out of Highland Community College. It's a leadership forum, and what we are doing is we're dropping people right into the zone boards, those dry meetings, those city councils. Let me tell you, it can be exciting, as Lori mentioned. It's a local-level issue, and this actually has a curriculum-based program that we're absolutely embracing in this part of the country.
Mm. That's a good idea. Casey, thanks for calling. Josh is on the line. He's from Harlan, Iowa. Josh, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Uh-huh. Go ahead.
I wanted to talk a little bit. I am a college freshman right now, mm-hmm. and I was a high school senior during the Iowa caucuses and things like that, and I even struggled to get a lot of interest going when we had very monumentous caucuses, as you all well remember, mm-hmm. and we still were trying to get people motivated, particularly people my age. I think a lot of my friends and classmates were willing to talk the talk but not walk the walk. Got a lot of early interest, but not a lot of turnout when we would have our caucuses and things. So
is it just boredom? I mean, why do people fall away?
You know, I just think that people get swept up in the momentum, but as it goes on, you know, politicians kind of just start to grate, and then they realize, well, you know, he's not a, you know, great guy of change. He's, you know, just another talking head on the TV anymore.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Josh, thank you. Lori Waters, let me get your last, leave us with your one last solution for this problem of civic participation. What would you say? They're on the ground doing this every day. What's your advice?
I would advise, you know, for people to just find an issue that gets them excited and get involved in it, whether it's a local issue, a state issue, or a national issue. And, I mean, I'm 33 years old and I have two young kids. I take my kids to these meetings. You know, they're involved. They see it. Even my three-year-old can tell you who the president is. And it's teaching the next generation. And I think Virginia's done a pretty good job with our standards of learning, incorporating civics, but we've got to do more. And it's making it a household discussion that politics isn't a dirty word, civic involvement, volunteerism. You know, it's really reinvigorating that community spirit, and making it a family-oriented effort, so that it does get passed on to the next generation, and staying involved through it, even though it can be sometimes time-consuming or frustrating. But you can make a difference. I mean, I was elected at 27 years old, and so I think that more people can have an impact, especially on their local governments, if they just jump in there and go for it.
Lori Waters, thank you so much. Lori Waters, member of the Board of Supervisors for Loudoun County, Virginia. Appreciate your time, Lori. Thanks.
Thank you.
Senator Bob Graham, I can't let you go in the last few minutes of our hour here. I've got to ask you about the news on the torture debate now before the American public. In so many ways, this has to do with government. It has to do with what you're talking about, our confidence in government, the tone that it sets. You were one of only a few members of Congress who was briefed by the Bush administration on the CIA's covert anti-terror interrogation programs. In fact, you were one of the only such legislators now out of office, so you have a unique position to kind of help us understand what happened. You received briefings starting in 2002, I believe. I know you were sworn to secrecy, but did you have a moral obligation to say something or at least to privately raise loud concerns to the president about what was going on in the torture debate?
Jane, it was a different situation. Actually, there have been statements made about who was briefed about these methods, as there have been on other aspects of the Bush administration anti-terror policy, such as warrantless wiretaps. Speaking for myself, as chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee from mid-2001 until the end of 2002, I was not briefed on these interrogation techniques. Had I been briefed, I hope that my response would have been that our country has as one of its fundamental principles embedded in the Bill of Rights that persons should be free from torture, because it is inherently unreliable.
Well, but I would just point to a piece in the Washington Times today that says between 2002 and 2006, top Republicans and Democrats on the House and Senate Intelligence Committees, quote, each got complete benchmark briefings on the program. So I guess the question is, did you raise concerns to the president about about torture?
I can't speak for others, and I was on the Intelligence Committee for 10 years. My terms ended at the end of 2002, but I personally was not briefed on these interrogation techniques, and am frankly very frustrated that there are these allegations made that everybody knew about it. I think the policy of the Bush administration was to try to bring as many people into the net when they were going to engage in some questionable activity in order to give them cover. In this case, I was not in the net.
What do you say to the critique that President Obama has made that the country is less safe by releasing the so-called torture memos? What else do
you— I disagree with that. The administration of President Bush and Vice President Cheney never gave the American people any credible examples of where information was gathered by the use of these extreme interrogation methods that could not have been gathered by using the type of interrogation techniques that are fully vetted and legal in the United States. If there were such examples, I would have thought they would have brought them forward. If there are such examples, I would hope that the Obama administration would bring them forward. I doubt that they exist.
Finally, do you favor prosecution for the Bush lawyers or anyone who okayed the program?
Well, my feeling is that we have political institutions and we have judicial institutions. The judicial institutions have the responsibility of determining whether there's a sufficient amount of evidence to warrant prosecution, and then ultimately a jury will decide whether beyond a reasonable doubt the law has been broken. I think we ought to rely on those institutions. They're an important part of our democracy, and I think they will serve us well in this instance.
Senator Bob Graham, our guest this hour, former senator, former governor, and author of the new book, America, the Owner's Manual, Making Government Work for You. Senator Graham, thanks very much.
Thank you.
You can continue the conversation, listeners. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.